Hi, everyone. Welcome to the conference call for the HAI tab of the Patient Safety Measures Project. I'm going to do a quick roll call to begin, see who's on the call. Dr. Darrow Campbell?
I'm here.
Great. Jan Allison?
Here.
Sue Barnes?
I'm here.
Juan Sanchez?
Present.
Carolyn Scott?
Here.
Kathleen Squires? And Pat Stone? Pat Stone?
Oh, here, sorry.
Okay, no problem. And here we've got, should we go around?
Sure.
I'm Andrew Leisinga. I'm the project manager.
Elisa Mentali, project manager. Jessica Weber, research analyst.
Lindsay Tai, research analyst.
And Peter Attengood, the senior advisor for patient safety. Do we have any other NQF staff folks online?
Hi, this is Heidi Bosley, managing director of CDP.
Hi, Heidi.
Go
ahead. So we sort of had a little bit of a introduction yesterday, and I think we'll probably just jump right in today and begin our evaluation. We've already done our disclosures of interest on yesterday's call. The first...
Here, can I interrupt with you? Because I wondered about that, since this is Skip Campbell. As I wasn't there on yesterday's call, I just...
So, well, I guess we could have you do a quick disclosure. Do you have any interest to disclose?
Well, that's what I was just going to say. No, I don't. I have been very involved with the NSQIP since its inception, basically, but I didn't introduce this measure, and I don't think I have any conflict there. I just want everybody to know this is something I've been involved with for a long time.
Peter Angood and Skip, no, you don't have conflict there. In fact, that's viewed as an attribute for us.
Well, then... we'll, again, go ahead and get started, and we are starting out today with measure number PSM-0007-10, which is the risk-adjusted urinary tract infection outcome measure, and that was introduced by the American College of Surgeons. Do we have a representative from the American College of Surgeons on the line today? We don't know. If not, yeah, maybe we'll move to the next subject, and we'll wait for them to join the call. So we can go ahead and go to the surgical site infection measures, because I believe we have a CDC person on the line here. So we'll get started with PSM-0210. And do we have a CDC representative on the line?
Yes, this is Jonathan Edwards from the CDC.
Hi, John. Do you want to give a quick introduction of your measure, just to outline anything that you want us to know about it?
Sure. So there's a lot of similarities to the CLABSI measure, only in this case we're obviously talking about the main stratifier here is procedures, surgical procedures, and following surgical site infection. And just once again, just highlight this is an NHSN measure proposal, and it is tied to mandatory reporting.
Okay.
Patient prospective payment system. There are plans for this measure to be included and reported in that system, I believe, at least within 12 months of the beginning of the CLABSI reporting, which I think is January 1st, 2011. And I think we can get into some discussion, if you want to, about the actual enumeration of the events themselves. This measure is targeting the surgical site infections that are at the deep incisional and organ space sites that are detected on admission and readmission to hospitals. This is the stratifier of procedure category is similar to the CLABSI one for location type, in that the SSI risk are different among various different procedures, as you all know. And the standardized infection ratio is a summary metric, It's just in this case, it's calculated differently in that we're basing it on regression models that are predicting surgical site infection risk for each procedure. And so as different than the CLABSI, which is based on some stratification, this is based on a risk model that takes into account a larger number of factors and does not constrain those factors to have equal weight of importance in predicting surgical site infection risk. And this, as far as the time window goes, once again, similar to CLABSI, the definition for meaningful use of the SIR is tied to aggregating enough data such that the denominator of the SIR for this event would be at least one infection based on the predicting SSI from the aggregate data. And as far as reliability and validity, I think some of the same comments from Dr. Dan Pollack yesterday apply. I don't think I need to take more time to review those unless you have further questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Sanchez, I believe we have you as the discussion leader on this measure. Do you want to give some of your thoughts on that?
Sure. Well, going through the actual numbers, the impact, I think there should be no discussion about that. You know, if anybody has anything to comment on, we could do that. But I think the impact and the opportunities for improvement are pretty clear. The next part is the scientific acceptability in terms of the numerator. I guess as I understand it, this is one measure encompassing a number of different procedures, and I noticed from the Excel spreadsheet that several people were somewhat alarmed by the fact that you're putting together a bunch of different kinds of procedures here, which can be problematic. I mean, has that ever been done before where you are reporting a measure based on a number of different kinds of procedures?
Well, I think what has been done is this SIR, of course, has its roots back in the standardized mortality and morbidity ratios, and the intention is that if you can, in some population, with reasonable sufficiency, can measure different, in this case, risks by different subgroups, say those within different procedure categories, if you can adequately measure those, then as long as you calculate the SIR within each procedure correctly, then you have the ability to sum those numerators and denominators across multiple procedures. So the key is not that we're throwing all of the procedures together and then trying to predict risk equally across all of them. It's that we're building risk models within each procedure, and then once the statistic is gathered up, the numerator denominator for each procedure, then it can be summed across the categories, which goes back to the underlying details of this indirect standardization measure. And happy to talk further about the details if you want.
Okay, let me just, I'm not sure if this fits in with that discussion or not. This is Skip Campbell, but one of the inclusion procedures is knee arthroplasty. Does that really fit with, you know, for deep incisional infections and organ space infections? How does that work? I mean, it seems to have to be a different definition for organ space infection than a knee arthroplasty.
Well, we do have definitions that are accommodating all really those two sites, the deep and organ space, and they are available for all of the various different sites, body sites, including knee arthroplasty. I'm actually a statistician, so I'm not the most intimately aware of all of the details that you would be able to address. But I do believe we have standard definitions that have been used for a long time, and they have been validated, and we do have those. So,
okay, I haven't seen them. I don't know what they are, but I'll take your word for it.
And they're published on our website as well. So that's something we could provide more detail if was needed.
Could you comment on the coronary bypass with both chest and donor site incisions? Only SSI from the chest are included. Can you just explain that to me?
Okay. So in the NHSN, we have had defined procedures for those CABGs that had both a primary and a secondary site versus those where just a primary site was involved, meaning just the chest. And so we had defined two specific procedure codes in our system, and through our analyses and discussions and vetting of the analyses related to this general procedure of coronary artery bypass graft, with an in-house surgeon, Dr. Sandra Berrios-Torres, together we became convinced that predicting SSIs at the donor site, that we really don't have really enough adequate data collection to really predict infections at the donor site. For example, the surgery time, the duration in minutes, is something that is encompassed over the entire, you know, cut to close time. And what we're not really necessarily measuring is exactly detail specific to the donor site itself. So what we've done is we've prioritized focus on the chest infections at that site, regardless of whether they were had a donor site involved or not.
So the reporting would involve, see, for number two, it seemed that you're reporting, you're including both donor site and chest site infections, and, you know, they're apples and oranges, as you probably know.
No, actually, we don't want to include the donor site infections. So this is where what we want to promote going forward is the, in this particular case, four CABG procedures looking at the chest, predicting chest SSIs.
Okay. Well, that wasn't too clear to me. But it's just a chest, there's no donor infection counted at all.
Well, we have surveillance that allows those infections to be reported. It's just that in this measure,
right,
what is going to be included are just those that are the chest or the primary site infections for that particular procedure in this measure.
Jonathan, can you hear
me? Yes.
Hi. This is Teresa Horan and Kathy Allen Brinson. We just wanted to let you know that we're here.
Great.
You need to ask. We were muted before, so...
Okay. Do you have anything to add to that, Teresa?
Not to what you just said, but back to the previous point about the knee arthroplasties. We do have, as you mentioned, the organ space site of joint. There's which could be an infection site, and also bone infection, osteo, for those deep incision or deep organ space sites for the arthroplasties.
Maybe, so we're on this, Skip Campbell again. One, I'm just interested in your philosophy, because the American College of Surgeons has also taken up this direction, is to just focus on the deep and organ space infections and not superficial infections. Why did you do that?
Well, the superficial infections, there is overlap to those detected on post-discharge. And so thought is that the more serious infections, or maybe sometimes referred to as complex SSIs, we felt were the ones that were best linked to the measurement of risk for these procedures. And so since the a healthy proportion of the superficial incisionals, just in general, could be linked to an impact by the post-discharge aspect, we sought to exclude those from the measure. I don't know if Teresa Horan, my colleague, has anything else to add.
Yeah, I would just add to that, Jonathan, that, you know, with many of the states that have mandates for reporting surgical site infections, this issue of
the variability in post-discharge detection of SSIs, again, really focuses on the incisional SSIs, and that if you could sort of, if you were trying to level the playing field, then using or focusing only on the those that are readmitted and detected during the admission, you would be, you certainly could net a few of the superficial incisional, but most of the infections that you would net in that kind of surveillance would be the deep incisional and organ space ones.
Okay, what happens, just out of curiosity, what happens if the patient met at the original hospital and goes to a different hospital to have their organ space infection diagnosed and treated?
Well, usually the receiving hospital should notify the hospital where the surgery was performed that they've got one of their infections. And so the originating hospital should be counting that infection,
sure,
not the receiving hospital.
You're optimistic.
Oh, I know that that is happening, especially in states with mandates, because nobody wants to count them for themselves. So,
okay, should we go on?
Sure.
Any comments about the numerator time window, numerator details, or anything else in 2A? I guess the denominator details we can talk about. It sounds like duration of procedure plays a principal role in the principal role as a variable here. And I'm not sure that that's – yeah, could you explain something about that, Jonathan, in terms of the different procedures and whether that how much the duration of the procedure impact the infection rate for the different kinds of procedures? Is there a lot of variability there?
Yes, that absolutely. The duration of the procedure in minutes is heavily associated with differences in risks, not only from one procedure category to another, but within procedure category. And if I had the time, I could show you the details of how, for some of these models, just an increment of 10 minutes, every increment, every increase in the, you know, 10-minute increments of surgery by, you know, in duration in minutes is associated with an increase in risk. Now, you know, that is based on the statistical method, but it's definitely one of the most probably most influential factors in risk that I would say over all procedures that are included here as well as within the procedure itself.
And Jonathan, this is Pat. Those sort of results are on that spreadsheet from the logistic regressions, and you can see the intercept that, you know, actually the
coefficients.
I believe. Isn't that what you're saying?
Yes, that's absolutely right. I guess I didn't know that you had that in front of you. But, yes, so those are the details of our models that are predicting risk. And so if you were to look through that spreadsheet, you would see that duration, it's not always associated with every, you know, increase in risk in every increments of 10 minutes of duration. But it is definitely a very important factor throughout.
Up in most of the models.
Can I ask you about the reliability of wound classification and ASA classification?
These two factors have been, as you know, collected a long time with a predecessor system to NHSN called the National Nosocomial Infections Surveillance System, or NIS. And as we have increase of coding into OR systems, I suppose if data are, you know, rekeyed or double data entry is a factor, then there could be some issues there. There have been, you know, ongoing validations of those data within various facilities. I know that this type of validation is going on in a few states more systematically, and we conduct analyses of the data ourselves to feed back to any entity that seems like, you know, something like, for example, if a facility always was reporting one particular wound class and no variation, or if, you know, for one particular ASA class. I don't know if Teresa Horan, my colleague, could add anything to that.
Maybe just skip again. Maybe I have an issue about that, too, and one, I think it's important to bring that up. In aggregate, I think these things work fine. But at the local level, there's a lot of variability in how hospitals report, particularly AFA categories for a given patient. I've seen studies where there's 30 to 40% discordance in what anesthesiologists think is an ASA 3 versus an ASA 4 versus a 5. So it's more subjective than we would like to think. When you look at the whole country, it probably all evens out. But when it's possible for hospitals to sort of fudge data on in my most cynical view of it, or they just get it mixed up. And so I don't know if that's a limitation or not, but particularly for ASA, I think there's still a lot of confusion sometimes about wound classifications. There's been quite a few papers written about that. So those two issues are more subjective than we like to think.
Right, sure. I understand what you're saying. And thankfully, many times the way of categorizing the risk group versus the referent group within either ASA score or wound class is that they are categorized. Typically, and so I suppose, you know, in the case, for example, in any model where we're grouping, say, with ASA having the five levels, 1 and 2 versus 3 versus 4 and 5, that, yeah, there could be some ambiguity created by miscoding, for sure, the values of the, say, the upper groups, whether 3 versus 4 or 5. And so that's, yes, duly noted, Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. There are no exclusions, I see. Any comments on the risk adjustment methodology or anything else under 2A? That brings us to 2B, testing reliability and so on. I think you've gone over that already, and we've certainly talked about a lot about that yesterday.
Juan, could I interrupt? Skip again. I'm confused about how NHSN does this. What do they tell the hospitals? We've got these 10 categories of cases they're interested in. How is a hospital? Do you identify one category per month, or how do you do that?
So the way that the surveillance goes in general is that a facility or healthcare facility or hospital has the ability to choose at the month level of aggregation which procedures they plan to follow, okay? And so they could follow, say, for example, in a state without a mandate requiring them to report a certain set of procedures, they just choose the procedures they want to follow, and typically they follow for a certain number of months, say 8-10 months of the year, and they don't typically change, but they have been known to be able to mix up the number of procedures that they actually report. However, with 21 states reporting some of these data mandatorily by procedure category, then in those states, obviously, all of those facilities that have those procedures performed in the period are required to report that. So there is definitely typically consistency of reporting of these procedures over a fairly long period within the year, or maybe even perhaps the entire year in the case of mandated procedures.
But there may be some procedures where you won't get it. You know, deep sternal wound infections, the national rate is 0.4%. You'd have to wait a few years before some of the centers get one of those. Isn't that a problem?
I don't think it's a problem, because if there's an inherently low risk, say, for a given procedure, even the overall crude rate, as you suggest, that's going to be taken into account. And that's, I think, one of the benefits of the standardized infection ratio, is that if we expect or predict very low incidence or low occurrence of these SSIs, then we expect a few number of them, relatively speaking. And so it's adjusting for what we would predict based on models that have been developed from 3 years of data.
So, Jonathan, this is Sue Barnes from Kaiser Permanente and APIC, and I wonder if you could just speak to whether this measure, though, is the way it's written is requiring the NISQIP sampling of procedures from all 10 procedure categories, not one or the other or the other, but the way the measure is written, as I understand it, would require sampling from all. If you do all the procedures, you've got to sample from all. Is that not
okay.
true?
That's not true. The way that that we intended for it to be used is that it's comprising any subset of the procedures listed in the SCIP set of procedures. So that, for example, say, for instance, a state that requires, say, three of those, I think it's 11 procedures that we have that map to the SCIP subset in NHSN, that if they're following, say, three of them and another state is following, say, four or five or only one, it's that those data could all be rolled up. It's just that the we've limited the measure and the building up of an SIR to include up to those procedures in the SCIP set.
Okay, so any procedure, not all of the procedures.
Right. It's not anywhere the intention of our to require all of those procedures to be followed by all entities reporting this.
Okay, and I know we'll get to this when we talk about feasibility, but again, I want to just raise the issue that I know that legislation, both state-based and federal, is moving towards leveraging NISQIP data, but we're not there yet. So this would involve tremendous surveillance burden for those who aren't currently collecting this.
So tremendous in that if they were following even just one procedure, it still would be a substantial increase in burden.
Well, because they're not doing an SIR unless they are participating in NHSN, and I know everyone is moving in that direction, but not everyone is there yet. So just to give a voice to
sure.
that. To the
sure, I appreciate that comment, and I guess I just want to draw a distinction between those that have never performed this type of infection surveillance or are not doing it currently and then now needing to perform the surveillance of collecting the underlying data versus the burden of having collected the data maybe routinely or currently and then the burden of actually trying to calculate the SIR, which we intend to publish these models and make the data available and instruct those and perhaps even develop code, programming code, that would enable someone to be able to calculate this, even if they weren't reporting the data through NHSN.
Oh, I totally get that. I just want to raise the issue from a practical ground level perspective that this would be a challenge when you're moving from rate-based reporting to SIR, just raising the issue.
Okay,
I'm not
calculating the SIR and reporting.
Right. I agree that this is a better quality measure, but I just want to raise the issue that would present a challenge at the ground level.
Right, and we have been using the SIR in the NHSN and promoting it, and we've talked about how to calculate it in the APIC text. But, yes, there's definitely more to be done, and I definitely appreciate the comment about the move to doing calculating this measure.
Jonathan, this is Pat Stone. Regarding the reliability, and this is with, I guess, a bit of over all the SIR measures, and it still gets to me, but, there's a section on here, it's testing and analysis, 2B1, and it says the logistic regression models used in the SIR calculations were based on data from 805 facilities. Fine. We conclude, and you did give us some information, but not a lot. We conclude for the most part for the procedure categories, the data are robust enough to use determining the expected number of SSIs. I don't know how you can conclude that. You didn't give me any information. You just stated it. And for a few of the categories with the relatively smaller numbers of reported procedures, additional data may be needed to improve the models. You know, it's not published yet, and there's statements, and to me it's a bit vague. You know, I don't know when you would be including, what sort of numbers. Do you understand what I'm getting at?
Yes, I do. I understand. And I appreciate the comment. And so, yeah, I don't know that I'm going to be able to, on this call, give you, and I would prefer to have, some visual aid to be able to try and talk more clearly about this. But I appreciate the comment, and unfortunately, it is not a black and white issue, so that we all have some standard way of saying, oh, well, if you have this much data, you've this much volume, then, you know, the model is good. I mean, this is a matter of opinion, but the idea here is that...
I mean, if it's an endorsed measure that's going to be used for public reporting, how do you, then it becomes somewhat black and white. And how does a hospital say that it's not reliable for them or it is reliable for them?
Oh, so in this particular case, the measure doesn't necessarily depend directly. I mean, it depends. It's a combination of their data that they report together with the data from these models. So the way I take your question, Pat, is that how do you know that we have enough data to be able to say that these models that we built, that we've included the spreadsheet, that those are adequate for predicting SSI risk? And I would say that basically the idea is in that spreadsheet there's a number of procedures that we have with which to build a model. And I think that you have those numbers. And while we have data from 805 facilities, we don't have equal volume. I will definitely acknowledge that in that spreadsheet. And so what I can't do, going back to the black and white comment, is I can't give you a black and white if we have a certain number of volume, then they're adequate, and here's the reference for why, versus if we had fewer than that, here's the reference why. And so what we basically see ourselves doing is using quite a large number of procedures in most cases, and large being in the thousands, or maybe in many cases tens of thousands of procedures that we're building these models from. And so in the model building sort of topic, there is not a black and white decision rule of do you have enough data. And it gets a little bit more diffuse from there. But I definitely hear your comment, and this is an area where I think that there can be continual improvement, and there are plans to do that. In other words, as we have more data, as the volume increases, then we're able to show, for example, model fit. And those are getting into more statistical topics that I'm happy to go into, but not sure that we want to spend the time that way.
Well, I think the model fit is probably pretty important.
Well, so this is where, again, we don't have some of the visual aid, but the idea is that we're predicting these complex or deep incisional organ space SSIs detected on admission or readmission, excluding the post-discharge segment. And these models are, they have some statistics that we've calculated that are not ideal, but they are in the adequate range. I would say, many hovering around 0.7 in an area under the curve. And again, those are some statistical sort of jargon. And I know that I have not explained what that means, and it's going to be difficult to do so over the phone.
Sure. Okay. Within that spreadsheet, some of the model fits. I guess it goes back to Skip's comment about the low rate, but some of the model fits are.
Well, if there's low rates, again, with those models, let's say, and I don't have that right in front of me, And so, like, for one of the procedures, if there's just, I'm going to make up a number because they don't have it in front of me, but let's say that there are 50,000 procedures for of one particular type, and even though the incidence or overall rate may be low, we're still able to use those data to predict these complex SSIs, and if the incidence or risk is low, then we can use those data to say if a certain facility, how would you predict their SIR, their number of expected infections or predicted their number of infections, and then you would be able to do that, and it would take that into account.
Okay.
Okay, moving on. Exclusions, no exclusions, and risk adjustment, we discussed that. identification of meaningful differences in performance, I guess we've discussed that yesterday, and I don't know if anybody has any comments about that.
I just have one question about this, because I looked for it. It says that there's this publication expected in May 2010, IRs. Was that put out? Because I couldn't find it.
Yes, actually, this, let's see, we published our first state metric report, and it was focusing on CLABSIs. Well, it was exclusively focusing on CLABSIs. We had planned to put out state metrics and SIRs on SSIs, yet right before publication found that there was a programming error and didn't feel comfortable on the timeline pushing that forward, and we plan on making that available, published in the second report, which is now middle October is the target date of this year.
Okay. Because I did look for that on the website. I just couldn't find it.
Moving on to usability. Any comments? SIR usability, we kind of discussed it yesterday as well.
I have a practical question, Juan. Maybe this is what I hear from my hospital folks. They tell me that the interface is very slow. It takes a long time to upload data into HSN, and so they are very reluctant to, you know, go wholeheartedly into these kinds of measures because it takes so much time. If we expand and this measure becomes a very popular measure, is that going to be an issue in terms of, well, maybe that's more a feasibility question, I guess, but anyway, that's what I hear from my infection control people.
Okay, so, this is Jonathan, let me please address that. So we have, as I think as Dan mentioned yesterday, we have been for some time enabling facilities to import or electronically upload, if you will, their surgical procedure list for any period of time, whether that be a month for one procedure or for many procedures or for multiple months. They have the ability of uploading. As far as in the time-consuming data collection, it's really entering in or uploading those, getting those procedures into the system. And so in those facilities that have enabled the electronic upload of procedures, as long as they have the data complete and they follow the specifications that we've published, there are hospitals that are able to do that very quickly, and it doesn't necessarily take time. Now, I acknowledge that in those facilities that do not have an electronic upload and have to manually enter in procedure data, that definitely would incur a much, they would incur a much larger, heavier burden for data collection. But other than the getting in, you know, the importing or uploading the procedure data, then it's still just a matter of entering in those, you know, relatively few infections. Many times, you know, less than 5% of the procedures would have an infection. And in some cases, it's, as you pointed out, someone pointed out already, that it's even less than that. So we have, I think, anywhere from 13 to maybe 15% of the facilities importing successfully. And it's not that they can't import. It's that typically they have trouble working with their in-house sort of informatics or, you know, programming support to be able to enable the electronic upload to our specifications. We do have, as Dan and we had a discussion yesterday, as Dan Pollack mentioned, we are working with infection control vendors in promoting a newer standard supported by the Health Level 7 or HL7 and this clinical document architecture standard of allowing data from those systems to be imported. And we, for the last, I think, 6 months, have enabled those some of those vendors to be able to start importing or uploading data from their systems. And so we see that in the coming months that there's going to be an even greater frequency of use of that upload feature.
So just, again, this is Sue Barnes, to reiterate the surveillance burden issue is important at this moment, although we are moving towards automation of surveillance. As you indicate, NHSN is getting that capability and sharing the capability through the infection prevention surveillance vendors software, and then next through the EMR. But there is, as you mentioned, also only a small percentage of facilities who are able to do that right now. And so the manual entering of the data is truly time-consuming.
Yes. Yes, I understand that. And, again, I just would reiterate again, from my discussions, it's in the facilities that have, you know, quite a healthy number of procedures, even for one category in a given month, the limitation has been that they've not been able to navigate the management structure and get the resources to enable this file basically to be created. And I don't want to bog down too much into the details, but I hear your point, Sue, and definitely appreciate it. There's definitely burden. And I think that one of the things that we really need to be focusing on is figuring out a way for, prioritization to be given within hospitals to allow or enable these data to be exported. Perhaps another issue is that the data as captured in the facility's operating room sort of data system doesn't exactly match up with what we require. And so that's another issue that's limiting the importation, because we have had the importation electronically for years, even had it back in the NIST day. But for sure, it's definitely an issue.
I totally agree. I think that automation is an imperative. We're not quite there yet.
Yep.
So it's your assumption that the people, the hospitals that have, say, NISQIP and the STS database, that they would use that infrastructure to upload to, in terms of looking at the duplication of work here, would you anticipate that infrastructure that's being built as time goes on would be incorporated into this? Or this measure would be incorporated into that process so that there wouldn't be an additional burden on each facility?
I would say yes. I mean, as long as the data that are required for this measure, for these models, and in the NHSN are available in another system, then it really is a matter of some vendor or series of vendors sort of being able to solve that problem of generating out the data that we need in the right format, and then it's done, and then it's basically, it totally avoids the duplicate data entry.
So, for example, for cardiac surgery, 93 to 95% of all cardiac surgery programs in this country are using the STS database. So if you're going to require, and there are data elements within that data set that would, I think, satisfy the requirements for this measure. So, if you're going to have to duplicate the data entering and the manual entering, then I don't think there's any benefit of that. But if there can be some interface there, that would be helpful.
Right. I guess I'm not sure with the STS system if there's one solution, one actual system, you know, data system that is used by every hospital, or is it that they have a variety of systems? And I know this is getting into some of the more informatics data management issues, but as long as the source data system has the ability of having a program layered on it that can be executed, that can produce the data that we need in the format we need it in, then there is a solution there clearly, and it will work across any of the facilities using that system to report to the STS.
And I think the most important thing there is, well, the informatics part of it's very important, but another thing is to make sure that there's consistency in the definitions, because I'm not sure what definitions are being used for the CABG part of it, but in NISQIP and NHSN are using the CDC-based definitions. So that would make it a lot easier to do what you're asking, Juan.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, for STS, there are 10 vendors, but the data elements are quite specific. So, you know, each vendor, it's not like there's a lot of variability in terms of the data quality. And the specifics, the details are sort of standard. I think we're going to see certainly all cardiac surgery programs moving to STS, and we're almost there yet at this point. And NISQIP, I think, is quickly moving to be widely adopted by, you know, most surgical programs. So, you know, I think there has to be a solution. I mean, if there are definition differences or informatic problems that need to be worked out, I think those need to be discussed up front, because it would be a shame to have to duplicate the data entry process here.
Right. I might mention that we have discussions that we've been in with the American College of Surgeons, and so we are continuing to work with them and discuss and see how we can collaborate together moving forward.
Okay, any other comments?
This is Teresa Horan. I just wanted to say that, you know, again, as Jonathan mentioned, any vendor, software vendor that can have access to the implementation guides for importation or for configuring their systems to provide the data in the CDA file format that NHSN needs for both the operative procedures and the surgical site infections. That information is posted on our website. I think we've spent most of our efforts working with infection control software vendors, but we would welcome contacts from the STS vendor community to see if we can't begin to, you know, get them on board with the CDA methodology that they could layer onto their systems.
Hi, this is Andrew from NQF. I just wanted to interject for a moment and just sort of talk about a schedule adjustment, since we had skipped over the first UTI measure that we were going to talk about at the beginning of the call. We're going to try to address that at about 2:10, and we're going to try to wrap up the discussion of the SSI measures by 2 o'clock. So just a note on time, so we should sort of try to keep ourselves moving along here. Thanks.
Well, I think for this measure, I'm not sure there's much more to discuss.
Juan, can I just ask one more question? How does this relate to the NQF, what is it, 299? The measure that's already out there from your group and SSI? 0299.
This is Andrew again, and we got clarification from the CDC that this was intended as a replacement for that measure.
That was a rate, and this is a ratio. I think that was the only difference, right?
This is Teresa Horan. For the original measure, the SSI, it was a rate measure, but it used all infections, all the SSIs, so those that were detected during the admission on post-discharge surveillance and readmission, as well as the superficial incisional, deep incisional, and organ space. So it was a different measure than this one.
So it wasn't tied into procedures?
Oh, it was. It was procedure-specific SSI rates, whereas this one is a more limited set of infections and a more limited set of operative procedures. And then the metric is the SIR, as Jonathan has explained.
Well, I think for this measure, the only other thing to discuss is data collection strategy we discussed and cost to implement the measure, I think we touched on. I don't know if anybody has any comments. If not, I think we've gone through this one. Andrew, is this?
All right, so should we move on to the next measure then?
Yeah.
Okay. The next one we have up in the queue is PSM-006-10, the risk-adjusted surgical site infection outcome measure, and that was also submitted by the American College of Surgeons, so we should check to see if we have anybody on the line from ACS right now. Operator, have you had anybody from the American College of Surgeons join us?
And if we do have someone online, could you please
okay.
press star zero at that time? Again, that's star zero, and we can open your line. And it appears no one has dialed in at this time.
Okay, Andrew, the other one is also American College of Surgeons, the one that's going to be at 210.
Right, right. So maybe I guess we should at this point move on to the number 8, PSM-008-10, which is the surgical site infection rate for ambulatory surgery. And that was submitted by the ASC Quality Collaboration. Do we have anybody online from the ASC Quality Collaboration?
Caller, your line is open.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Hi, this is Donna Slothberg with the ASC Quality Collaboration.
Hi, Donna. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
If you want to...
I'm not sure, but could you have the operator check and see if Kim Wood is on?
And we do have Kim Wood. I can go ahead and open your line.
Thank you.
Ms. Wood, your line is open.
Thank you.
Okay. Good afternoon. I'm Donna Slothberg. I'm the Executive Director of the ASC Quality Collaboration, and also on the phone is Dr. Kim Wood. She's one of our co-chairs. I understand that there is time limitations, so I'm just going to briefly, I realize that probably NQF is very familiar with the ASC Quality Collaboration because we currently have 6 NQF-endorsed measures, but I realize that everyone else may not be, so I'm going to give you a quick overview of our industry and organization. The ambulatory surgery center industry includes 5,200 Medicare-certified ambulatory surgery centers that perform more than 22 million surgeries each year. Patient stays are less than 24 hours, and typically patients stay for just a few hours, which means our involvement is limited in the continuum of the patient's care. The collaboration was formed in 2006, and it includes management companies, and some of those are Ambulatory Surgery Centers of America, AmSurg, HCA, National Surgical Care, NovaBed, Nutera, Surgical Care Affiliates, Symbion, and USPI, as well as professional associations, the Ambulatory Surgery Foundation, American College of Surgeons, and Association of Perioperative Nurses, or AORN, and accrediting bodies, the AAAHC, the American Osteopathic Association, and the Joint Commission are all involved with the Ambulatory Surgery Collaboration. We have developed and continue to develop standardized quality measures appropriate to the capabilities of ASCs. We do focus on harmonization, but must take into account that ASCs are different from inpatient hospitals in their code sets for billing. Hospitals use ICD-9 and ASCs use CPT codes. as well as the claim format used for billing. Hospitals use a UB04 and ASCs use a CMS 1500, as well as our patient population. And we feel that typically our population is already risk-adjusted because we typically see ASA 1s and 2s and occasionally 3s in our surgery centers. The measure that we're presenting today is surgical site infection rate for ambulatory surgery. A brief description is the measure identifies the percentage of ambulatory surgery admissions developing a postoperative surgical site infection within 30 days after the operation or within 1 year of the operation if an implant was placed. The numerator is the ambulatory surgery center admissions developing a post-op surgical site infection detected through surveillance within 30 days after the operation or within 1 year of the operation if an implant was placed. We did use the CDC definitions for surgical site infection for superficial incisional SSI, deep incisional SSI, and organ space SSI. And our denominator is all ambulatory surgery center admissions. And that definition is completion of registration upon entry into the facility. Given there is little in the literature on ambulatory surgeries, surgical site infection outcomes, we feel implementing this measure will give us a better understanding of the incident of this outcome. This will allow for standardized reporting of SSI on a national level and allow ASCs to benchmark their results and therefore focus their quality improvement efforts. There is no mandate at this time for quality reporting in ASCs. In closing, we look forward to your recommendation and appreciate everyone's time in reviewing this measure. Thank you.
And Jan, are you still there?
Yes, I am here.
You want to lead the discussion on this one?
Okay. We'll just move right along with it and begin with the importance to measure and report. For impact, opportunity to improve, and evidence to support, we have a general consensus that these are complete, but have a couple of minimal scores under the opportunity for improvement. So does anyone want to express those concerns?
I don't know. I get maybe this is a general comment to skip. I'm wondering how this actually is going to work because the data has to be reliable. And I'm skipping ahead to that part of it. And the way I understand this, there's 20 million ambulatory care cases done a year in ambulatory surgery centers, and you want data on every single one of them. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Taking, especially when you want 30-day follow-up. And so I, you know, being a practicing surgeon myself, I know that when I do an outpatient case, I rarely, you know, see the patient 30 days later. I have no clue. I mean, you know, I don't necessarily know whether they have an infection or not. So how reliable do you think the information is going to be if it's not audited and you're relying on the surgeon to, you know, make a check mark someplace to say that the patient didn't have an infection. And then that being the case, then how do, you know, if it's kind of fuzzy about some of that, how do we use the information to improve?
Yeah. You're correct that it's a large ask to survey for all patients, but it is the typical practice in an ambulatory surgery center to survey surgeons on all patients at a point in time that puts the question to the surgeon at or after the 30-day mark, and similarly to develop a tickler file that puts the question for those patients who had an implant during the operation at or after the one-year mark. So it's a fairly standard procedure in the ASC setting to survey for all patients.
I'm sorry, I don't know this literature very well, but can you audit it, or how do you know what the validity of the information is?
It would have to be audited.
And has that been done? Or
I'm not aware of a standardized audit practice.
Okay. I'm not, you know, maybe it's perfectly reliable, but I just think that the surgeons don't necessarily know whether their patient got, you know, some, and you're looking at superficial as well as, you know, or, you know, deep in organ space also. So
yes, I think your points are well taken. The surgeon certainly may have seen the patient at post-op day 7, for example, and while the ASC poses their question on day 30 or after, the information that the surgeon relies on to complete the form may, in fact, come from a period that is incomplete if it's based on assessment on day 7. It is a legitimate issue.
The other thing I was a little confused about, and I'm sorry if I'm skipping around a little bit, but in your, are you, ASC, for instance, we do a lot of endoscopies, like upper endoscopies and colonoscopies and so forth. That wouldn't be relevant to the surgical site infection kind of data. But I thought in reading this pretty carefully, it seemed like you were wanting to include those.
Yes. Our work group had a lot of discussion around this issue, and because we worked through consensus, the consensus was that we would attempt to devise a measure that relied more heavily on feasibility for ASCs, because the work group felt it would be very difficult for many surgery centers to pull out those cases. So what we end up with is a measure that has a inflated denominator.
Yeah, because there, I mean, it's not, an SSI isn't really relevant to an endoscopy per se.
I agree. Your point is very well taken.
And I wonder also, this is Sue Barnes from Kaiser and APIC, how this measure would harmonize with some state-based legislated mandatory reporting. For instance, in Colorado, their ASCs are required to report hernia procedure SSI. So this would be in addition to that. And I wonder why the approach wouldn't be to select based on what the most, maybe starting with the most common state-based required procedure SSI.
Yeah, and certainly that is one approach that we considered. But again, the consensus of the work group was to take a broader approach. Your point is extremely well taken.
This is Juan Sanchez. Can I ask about your survey instrument? Is that structured? Is that in reading the measure here? It says an inquiry, for example, questionnaire, phone call, et cetera. It seems like that could be just about anything. How do you standardize the data collection tool, across sites? And how do you get the practitioner? Many of these docs are pretty hard to get, and you're going to really incur an undue burden trying to track these people down to get the practitioner to answer the question.
We had not made any attempt to standardize an instrument for use across the industry. Again, we're aware that it's very typical for ASCs to have a process for surveying their surgeons already in place, and we didn't sense that it would be well received for us to develop something that might not work for each and every center. And so we do not have a standardized instrument, but I'll come back to the comment that it is a standard process for surgery centers to go through, although the process may not be identical from center to center, to make an attempt to contact surgeons regarding all patients who have had surgery at the center within the specified time frame.
Not being an outpatient surgeon, I don't know how difficult it is to obtain this information. You probably have some sense of that.
Well, it is very different depending on the surgeon. Some surgeons are very motivated to report. Others, centers have difficulty getting data from. There's a broad spectrum of willingness and timeliness on
consider both the reliability of the data and the feasibility of collecting the data?
I think it does.
Okay, was that all the comments? We can go ahead and move on to the scientific acceptability. I know this section will likely drive the most significant discussion based on the scores, and we've already covered some of that. As far as precisely specified, there's considerable variability in scoring this, so does anyone wish to voice those concerns? Okay. On the reliability testing, there were definite concerns that have already been spoken on that, and there is reference to the CDC definitions and surveillance protocols. I kind of had a little bit of concern in this, not just with what's already been addressed, but I have personally seen some substantial variability in the identification of infections by the practitioners in the ASC. If a culture wasn't done, then it wasn't an infection, and that's not necessarily meeting the definition. So is it thought that having this measure in place will drive more consistency because there'll be education that will be brought out? I mean, what are we foreseeing will happen in regard to driving better understanding of reporting infections accurately? Am I making sense?
Yeah, I think I understand your question, and I think the goal is to drive greater consistency. For example, sometimes I'll hear from a practitioner that the patient didn't follow postoperative instructions and developed a surgical site infection, but they're not willing to count that as an SSI. Those are the types of things that we would like to try and eliminate by having consistent definitions that are not going to vary according to factors that people might have in their mind, like cultures or following post-op instructions, et cetera. So the goal is to get something that is consistent out there in terms of definition and educate people on that definition and have them start using it across the board.
Yeah, well, I might, and I don't know if this comment really falls in with this, but I feel like in the surgery center industry, the lack of accountability and public reporting is likely a significant factor in the variability and poor follow-up in tracking and outcomes of infection. So I do agree with you guys that adopting a standard approach provides probably for more accurate benchmarking leading to implementation of improvement strategies. It's just right now there seems to be just a long way to go in trying to achieve that reliability and validity of the data. So any other comments in regard to reliability or even?
I looked up your website last night just to get an idea of, I think it's a great, great group, and I think you're doing some very good things. But to me, it seems like this measure doesn't have the same rigor that the other six that you've already, you know, got does, in my estimation. I mean, it's easier to identify burns that happen in an ambulatory or falls. You know, those kinds of things are much more easily measurable, I would think, than this particular one is, which really takes a lot of work. If you really want to know what the infection rate is at 30 days, somebody has got to call these patients. And you, for 20 million people to call them at, 30 days and find out if they really did have an infection, that's a lot of work. And then make sure that there's education so that the person who's calling knows what a superficial infection is, what a deep, that kind of thing. That just seems like an enormous burden to me.
Yeah, and this is Pat. I guess from when I read this measure hasn't been tested at all. There's a statement about due diligence for reliability and validity, but am I right to say that this hasn't even been pilot tested?
It has been informally pilot tested. We have, and I think Donna can speak to this more than I can. I think she has the figures. But a number of surgery centers have been participating in a pilot project to develop and report the data on this measure.
But none of that data was given to us.
That's right, because it was ongoing at the time that the measure submission was made.
This is Donna. There is some testing that is actually in the criteria under data sampling. It showed 148 surgery centers for 3 consecutive months, and then it had the admissions and the range from 0.0% to 0.79. We've also been collecting this data for fourth quarter of 09 and first quarter of 10. There was 514 ASCs participating in fourth quarter with 653,608 admissions with a 0.04% infection rate ranging from 0.0% to 0.07. And first quarter, 1,179 ASCs participated with 1,325,499 ASC admissions with a 0.05% infection rate ranging from 0 to 0.07%.
But Donna, this is, Skip again, Tuck. It's from a point of view of a surgeon, I think you're going to lose the surgical community at this issue about putting colonoscopies and gastroscopies in the denominator. It just doesn't make any sense. And some of these ASCs, half of what they do is endoscopy or more. So I think that's something, my constructive suggestion was that needs to be fixed.
Okay. And your point is well taken. As Dr. Wood said, there was a lot of discussion with the group. It is a collaborative effort. Dr. Wood and I are typically involved in the TAPS and the steering committee, so we hear what you're saying. And we certainly would consider going back and reworking that denominator if that is an issue that is keeping this measure from moving forward.
And this is Carolyn Scott. The testing results that you shared with us, I'm assuming that too was based on information that wasn't necessarily collected in a standard survey format or questionnaire?
No, it was not.
Okay.
This is Heidi Bosley, just NQF staff. Just to follow up on that, just so we understand a little bit more on the pilot testing. So you have not done, in that pilot testing, any reliability or validity testing within those sites? You've just collected the data, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So I think that just is from a staff perspective, again, the committee, it would be helpful for this TAP to provide some input to the steering committee on whether you feel that this really does adequately meet the criteria for scientific acceptability on reliability and validity.
Okay. Should we move on? Exclusions. And here we have some variability. And I just go ahead and like to open that up for comments. I didn't really have any.
I didn't understand what Skip has now told me about colonoscopies. So I think that there's not enough exclusions.
All right, and on risk adjustment, there is no risk adjustment for this measure. And then identification of meaningful differences in performance. Sorry, I'm looking here. I kind of lost my sight here on where we're at on that scoring. It looks like everybody was pretty much in agreement there. So we can go ahead and move on to usability. Useful for public reporting and quality improvement.
That's what I would. I just think it's limited, and it's a application at this point because it's just not going to be meaningful to say that my ASC has a very low wound infection rate when half of the cases, in the denominator that doesn't apply. I think it's limited. That's, I've already said that, so I'll just shut up. But that's what I think about that.
Okay, and did we have any comments on the harmonization of it? And the additive value to existing measures, I think everybody has really voiced pretty much all the comments that can be said about regarding that. Feasibility, data generated during the care process. I think we our discussions covered that area as well. Any additional comments? Electronic sources. I really see the challenge until we get ASCs up and running on having a more standardized and consistent process like the hospitals do for a lot of their data gathering. You know, there's just not a lot of electronic sources in regard to the data collection for this particular measure. A lot of it's manual, and that does create a lot of, vulnerability to errors in the quality of the data. Any other comments? Okay. Susceptibility to inaccuracies looks like, I mean, we continue to have some variability in the scoring through here and in the data collection, but does anybody have additional comments that haven't already been made in regard to this area? Do we feel that we've pretty much have closed out the comments on this topic?
I had one question for maybe for Donna. It's, you have a sentence in here that I was just perplexed at, that if the measure is not endorsed, our leadership will need to determine whether the value of publicly reporting measure results overrides the lack of NQF endorsement for the measure itself.
I can speak to that. When we publicly post quality data on our website, we prefer that the data that is put out there comes from a measure that has gone through a rigorous process and has been thought about in detail and that we feel entirely comfortable with. NQF's review and endorsement of measures gives us that comfort. And so if, as we will do, we go back to our work group and say, you know, there are significant flaws in this measure, things that we identified during our discussion, it is very likely that our leadership group will then take that information and determine that the data that we have already collected is not something that is valuable and would not decide to post it on the website. I hope that helps.
But if the data haven't been validated and there's differences in measures in collection and there's inflated denominators that are vary across sites, that might be a good thing. I mean, is that what we're saying, that, you know, we don't know if there's consistent definitions. We're not sure that the process denominators are inflated based on the patients of different ambulatory care settings, the different types of patients. So we don't really know what the denominator is because it includes... I guess I'm just having the more I think about it, the more problems that I'm seeing and would like to, although I know this is a huge problem and would like to really see a good measure.
Right. My personal opinion, and again, I think the ASC is doing a lot of good things and it's sort of in its infancy right now, but my constructive suggestion is this needs some work and you want it to be a really good measure when it comes out, that because people will, you know, inevitably start poking holes at it, and I think just maybe rethinking what it is, that's my suggestion.
And I think it is very valuable to us to have your input. It's very meaningful to our work group, and it helps us tremendously, and we, I know, have been taking notes, and we'll take all this very much to heart and hope to develop a much sounder measure as a result of your input. So we thank you so much for it.
Okay. Can I just ask about the comment in 4E2, no additional costs would be incurred by the majority of facilities. If a facility's not doing it now, wouldn't that really, in fact, add an additional substantial cost to that facility? And how many facilities are actually doing some kind of survey after patients leave the facility?
Donna, if you don't want to speak to that, I will. All the centers that I'm familiar with have a process in place for surveying their surgeons for surgical site infection following the procedure or operation.
So all you're seeking to do is report that?
In a standardized fashion, yeah. Using the same definition.
Do you think the standardization incurs additional costs to the system or to a particular facility?
I don't think it would impose additional significant costs, no. Because if the process is already in place and just needs to be tweaked somewhat in order to bring it in line with a standard definition, I don't see that incurring a lot of cost.
And I agree with Kim. This is Donna.
So you don't think a facility would require a new FTE in order to comply with the measure in any way, even to collate the data once received? I guess they do that already.
I think that they do.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I can speak for Kaiser Permanente's ASCs or those that we're associated with, and it's my understanding that that's not necessarily the case in every ASC, that they would have this a robust system in place. So I would just caution that this may very well involve additional resources.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, have we got this one wrapped up?
I think maybe we do. And so at this point, I would ask the operator to see if there's anybody from the American College of Surgeons who's joined us yet.
And if we do have anyone on, please press *0 at this time. Again, that's *0. And I believe we have Mr. Cohen on. One moment, I'm going to open his line. And Mr. Cohen, your line is now open.
Hi. Hello. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. I'm sitting in for Bruce and Karen. I've just had like 30 minutes notice, so I may not be up to speed on all the issues that have been discussed on this.
Okay. Do you know the measures we're discussing today?
Yes.
Okay. We skipped over the UTI measure. We're going to come back to that one. So I think we'll start out because we've just been talking about a couple of other SSI measures. So we'll talk about the surgical site infection rate measure, which is PFM 00610. If you could just give a brief overview of that, tell us anything you want us to know about it.
You know, I can we just skip that? I'm just bringing this up.
Sure.
To my computer.
Sure. Yeah. So we have. I think we had Dr. Campbell, you as the discussion leader on that one. Do you want to?
Sure. Well, I can just start off, but maybe give a little bit of an overview of this measure. Like the other one we talked about, the NHSN measure, it focuses on the deep infection and the organ space infections rather than the superficial. And we heard a little bit. I think the rationale would probably be the same, because this measure is designed for folks that are not participating currently in the formal NSQIP, which is a more expensive endeavor. And the idea would be that it would minimize the burden on hospitals to try to do the surveillance, the 30-day surveillance, just by focusing on the cases that would ordinarily be readmitted or identified during the initial hospitalization. So I think the CDC definitions are the same in the two different measures, but the fundamental difference is that the NHSN uses this stratification process using raw numbers by procedure types, and the NSQIP uses a risk adjustment methodology that, you know, they argue would make it easier for a hospital to compare itself reliably to other hospitals, and that is a strong stimulus for quality improvement. They make the statement in here that it perhaps is a stronger impetus for self-improvement using the risk adjustment data than it is than NHSN data, which I'm not.
Thank you, Laura.
500 cases, I guess, in most hospitals of the list of CPT codes they're interested in order to get reliable data, and maybe Dr. Cohen can tell us a little bit more about that in a minute. But so it's sort of an NSQIP light, I think, for SSI that might be applicable to many more hospitals than the 250 that are currently in NSQIP.
Yeah, that's true. I'm still trying to bring this stuff up. It's using, like, I think, 4 predictors, but I'm not sure. I have to search that out. I'm sorry, I'm not prepared for this, but.
All right, I think the 3 predictors, typically the NSQIP data set, there's a whole host of things that are measured in order to get a very complete picture of the risk profile, but as time has gone on, it's been realized that you don't really need.
You've dropped out. I've lost. Hello?
Can you hear us?
Now I can.
Okay, great.
I think that the folks that have been involved in this have realized that there's quite a burden of data collection for a nurse or someone else to collect all this data, so that it would be nice if we could have fewer variables to collect to assess risk, and they actually have boiled it down to 3, actually. And I think, as I remember, it was CPT code, ASA, and wound classification gave a C index. It was really about the same as it was when you use many times that different number of variables. So it makes it easier and more feasible for hospitals that are not participating in the NSQIP formally to participate and get some idea of where they stand relative to other hospitals in the country with regard to these kinds of SSIs. So that's basically the idea.
Dr. Cohen, are you on the webinar currently?
No, I'm not.
Would you like us to send you copies of the measures? Would that be helpful?
If you can send me what you have, I'm trying to get it. Yeah, that would be helpful.
Could you give us your email address quickly?
Mark Cohn, MarkCohen, at facs.org.
Okay, great. We'll shoot those over to you.
All right.
Can I ask about the variables? It's CPT group, ASA class, and wound class. It doesn't sound too different from the CDC adjustment methodology.
It does not.
You know, and when you talk about the robustness of the risk assessment here, risk adjustment, when you boil it down to those 3, it's not any different than the other one.
Well, you could look at it that way, yeah. That was the same variables, basically.
Excuse me, this is Teresa Horan. Are we allowed to speak from CDC?
Sure.
Because I think these are 2 quite different models. Remember, ASA and wound class might or might not be included in the risk model for a particular procedure. They are. It depends on that procedure type.
And in your version of it.
In our, yes. So to say that, you know, ASA and I mean, that these three factors are the same as our risk models, I think is a bit, yeah, it's not quite accurate. And the CPT grouping, we don't have anything similar to that. And
okay. Okay. So it's not exactly the same, you know, it's not exactly the same metric, but the things that are similar, I guess I was just trying to point out the things that were similar was that the CDC definitions were being used, and it's the only if both systems don't collect the superficial SSI, and idea would be that many hospitals could participate because the burden of you know, data collection would be lessened. Those are the three ideas that I had.
Yeah, one of the things that may not come through is that the CPT grouping is based, I think, in this version on about 137 different buckets of CPT codes, which seem to be very powerful in predicting SSI when combined with ASA and wound class.
Okay, but Mark, I'm sorry that you're kind of trying to do all this at once. What we were basically looking for from you, from the college, was, you know, what the benefits of this particular approach are to the country in terms of understanding our problems with HAI. What are the benefits of your particular approach here?
Karen's here. I'm not prepared to answer these.
Sorry, I didn't hear that question. I've got to go back on another conference call. I'm sorry.
There is about the benefits, the countrywide benefits of having this SSI measure.
Yeah, there are potentially lots of HAI measures out there that, you know, could be endorsed, but we would just like to know what you think the particular benefits or attributes of this one are.
I mean, I think the high quality of the data in itself and the risk adjustment methodology, which is tried and tested, really allows for hospitals to improve their quality of care, and as a national measure with such well-defined variables and such... that these measures would allow hospitals to really... benchmark against each other and to really drill down and develop QI initiatives around these particular variables for these measures. I'm sorry. I'm so another call. I just walked by.
And I grabbed her because I was prepared to answer these sorts of policy level questions.
The idea here is this is a hospital-level analysis, and so a hospital might be able to compare itself to, you know, two other hospitals in its particular location or nationally, or depending on how large the hospital is or small the hospital is, et cetera, et cetera. And the pitch that's made in this document is that is a powerful motivator for quality improvement. And, you know, I'm not prepared to say that that's more powerful than the NHSN, you know, methodology in stimulating quality improvement, but it does, it adds to a certain level of competitiveness, I guess you'd say, if you know that your neighbor is doing a little bit better on a risk adjustment basis than you are. So that might be an attribute of this model.
Correct, and we have been in communications with the CDC on their measure. You know, there have been some differences in the past between the measure that they had been using previously, and so we have been looking at ways to work together to bring those into some sort of an alignment.
But the CDC measure that's proposed, as well as this measure, I mean, I think when we get to that talk about harmonization and such. I mean, I know these both of the measures haven't been, endorsed yet, but they are, in my mind, very similar. I don't want to use the word competing measures, but I don't know if that's right. But, Andrew, can you talk to us about what we should do about these? Because they're both very, there's differences.
There are definite differences in the measures, and honestly, I don't know what's behind these ones.
from CDC. We have had some discussions, but I don't know the particulars of what they've actually submitted at this point in time.
I can just interject here. I think the purpose of what the TAP should be doing right now is simply, you know, analyzing and making constructive suggestions to the measure, and then for both measures, even though they do seem to be competing to some degree, and then the steering committee can make that.
That's right. You're just looking to sort of give us a discussion of the strengths and weaknesses, try to identify those for each measure.
Right. So we'll just try to point out where we think there might be.
So I do have a very specific question about the measure. If one of the things it says under 2A23, and I don't know if you have that, so I'll sort of read it to you. It says, based on the denominator and required sample size to achieve a reliability of 0.4, hospitals would take a systematic sample to achieve the minimum sample size. But that's only fair reliability. And, you know,
Mark could comment on that. Mark, isn't that down your alley there?
It is, but I haven't been down this alley for a few months.
The way I read it, what you would ask a hospital to do, depending on their case volume, you would like to have enough volume to get to this reliability of, what was it, 0.4 or something like that?
Yeah, which they say is fair.
Fair. I'm not familiar with that approach, but maybe you could explain that to us.
Yeah, and just to take Mark off the hot seat for a moment, we didn't receive notice of this, you know, in a timely enough fashion that we could really have somebody available. In fact, I had emailed back saying we were unavailable. So I feel sorry for Mark at this point, and like I said, I was at another call right this moment. So I apologize for us not being able to better answer your questions at this point. It's just with the amount of time and not being able to, you know, participate, we didn't anticipate getting a phone call this afternoon. So I apologize for not being more prepared.
This is Heidi.
Sorry, if I could just step in for a second. It's Peter Angood, the Senior Advisor for Patient Safety at NQF, and thank you for your explanation there. Many of us have been stuck in similar situations where we're trying to pitch hit when we're not able to become fully prepared, so we understand. Similarly, though, we do have many members on our TAP here who have complex schedules, and so we are going to persist with you to try and tease out the issues as best as we can, and we certainly do not want to embarrass anyone in this process. However, we need to try and get our work done as well, and as Skip mentioned a few moments ago, there isn't going to be any real pivotal decision-making today. We're just trying to tease out issues, and then as we prepare for our steering committee call, that will then begin to make decisions about these. In the interim between today and then, if we need a bit further clarification via email or another call, then we'll try to set something up. But I just wanted to state that we do recognize your situation, but we are going to persist a little bit if you can tolerate us. Thank you.
This is Heidi. If I could just follow up, one thing we could do here as staff is if there are specific questions that you feel that, you know, Mark's just not quite yet prepared to answer and Karen's obviously not available, we can follow up with them and provide a written response back to the TAP, and then you can do your formal evaluation by SurveyMonkey, you know, your final one. So if there's something we find here, just kind of highlight it for staff, and we'll make sure that we follow up with Mark and Karen after this.
All right. Well, let's go ahead with our usual format then. Unless Mark, you want to have any further comments, or just want to listen to the discussion?
I've dug a deep enough hole already. I'll jump into something if I think I can add anything.
Measure report. Did anybody have my SurveyMonkey is not working right now. My computer's not working, so I don't have that in front of me, but. Does anybody have any issues with regard to the importance of the subject?
We had a unanimous decision on that. Everybody found it to be an important measure. We've got it up on the webinar if you have access to that. right now?
Scientific acceptability of measure properties. Any interest, any question about the numerator statement? Definitions?
I just have a quick question. Identifies a list of CPT surgical procedures that are incorporated. Is that available somewhere? Because it's not in the measure itself.
Typically, it's general and vascular surgery procedures. You know, for the most part. But which ones they are, I don't know, and that's a question. E-codes, I'd like to see that.
I thought I missed the attachment.
No, I didn't see it either, so.
Could you clarify what the question was again?
So in 2A1, it says that at the end there, it says within 30 days of any... I guess I'm misreading this question. I guess the issue is there a list of CPT codes that are included in this measure? Could we get can we look at that?
Yeah.
Okay. It says see separate list of APS NISQIP measures, CPT codes, but it wasn't there.
Well, we can send you a list of the ACS NISQIP codes. There's about 2,000 in there.
This measure. You see what I mean? I got the feeling that you were sort of truncating that. So it wasn't every single CPT code, was it? It says, as defined by the American College of Surgeons, within 30 days of any NSQIP listed CPT surgical procedure. Okay, maybe I'm wrong. So maybe it is every single CPT code?
I think that's true.
Or is it for multi-specialty? Must be just general and vascular, I would think. So that would be a question. Maybe you could just follow up on that, Mark, and get back to us. What is the scope that we're talking about here?
Okay, I'll get back to with that.
And the denominator said, yeah, again, it says see separate list of NISQIP CPT codes. Okay, exclusions. The exclusions are trauma and transplant cases, which NISQIP typically doesn't measure anyway, and then brain dead people. So that's. Interestingly, that. That's where there is no harmonization with the NHSN, I don't think, because I don't. Any comments about that? The risk adjustment methodology. Now, Mark, I know you're an expert on that.
I am. I just think that we were using a hierarchical model here, but I'm not sure. We had gone both ways, and I'm not sure what the final submission was either logistic or hierarchical. Okay, I'm reading it now. Yeah, we were using the fixed portion of the hierarchical model, the no best lender, no blup option in stats.
Using the three selected variables, not 40, but three.
Right.
Looks like the prediction's pretty good.
It's just as good as it was with all those different variables. So that's kind of interesting. Up with outliers, so that's what you end up with. So,
I this good with just a few outliers with the C statistics of 0.8? Is this something that you think that, I'm sorry, it's very noisy outside my office. Oh, they just stopped. Is this something that you would think about to reduce burden, changing some of your other models?
You mean the other ACS NISQIP models in general?
I think I can speak to that, Mark.
We do have plans to change our modeling strategy to eliminate some standard variables that we collect that we don't actually use. That's happening. We're going to light versions of a lot of these. But the motivation is a little bit different because hospitals in this group typically want to collect a lot of these variables for their own research purposes, so there's not not a great motivation to reduce it to 3 or 4 or 5. But we find that by the time we get to 8 or 9, we've asymptote on the C statistic by then. So they're very, very marginal improvements after that.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions about the modeling, the risk adjustment? Okay. What about the testing, the reliability testing? You're going to get back to us on what? Well, I'm looking at more moderate reliability estimate with X number of cases, and so that's. And what the bottom line was, it ends up for most hospitals, I thought I read 200 to 500 cases typically.
That's correct.
Which is thought to be doable, at least to the degree that you'd have a part-time FTE collecting this kind of data. And now it wouldn't require one full FTE to do it, obviously.
Right.
Helpful here, but they can be manipulated a lot. They're not as objective as the CPT group is, I think. And there's just confusion among, it's funny to me that there's confusion among anesthesiologists who do this every day about, you know, what a 3 is and what a 4 is. And there's nothing we can do about that, I guess, but...
Can I ask about the rationale for excluding trauma and transplant patients?
We didn't have any way to model that effect because NISQIP doesn't collect any data on that. So we had no way of telling how that would work out in our modeling. Those patients are excluded from our database.
And there's a separate trauma quality improvement program that the college is working on.
Right.
That's where the trauma cases are collected. And I think they just thought the transplants were so different than the usual general surgery cases that they didn't fit very well.
The trauma data, NISQIP and the regular NISQIP talk to each other? I mean, can you obtain data from the trauma database through NISQIP? I'm not familiar with it, but.
It's sort of new. There's about 24 hospitals in TQIP right at the moment. I think, you know, probably some parts of it could, but there's many, many of the outcomes measures are specific to trauma. And so I don't think 100% of it is interchangeable, but.
That's true. They're very different platforms.
There's this interesting paper that's referenced in here about the comparability of the multiple data that was written about NISQIP and UHC, which we're not discussing today, but there was actually the point was that the NISQIP model for picking up complications was much more sensitive and identified quite a few more complications than the UHC administrative database did. Comment, any other members of the committee, what are your thoughts about the strengths and weaknesses for scientific acceptability?
I think it's strong.
Other comments? I could call on people if I find my list, but I'm not hearing a lot of other comments about that. I think my impression is also that the validity and scientific accessibility is quite good. Although it must be said that you test it with the C statistic, but in the field there's no real field testing about this yet. It's so new. So I don't know if that's coming out at some point.
This a very similar measure is sort of the bulwark of a new Florida initiative where we're getting perhaps 100 hospitals coming in to collect these measures. So we're going to have pilot data using these measures pretty quickly.
These hospitals in Florida are all going to be on this QIP?
We have hospitals in Florida that are under standard ACS NISQIP, but a bunch are joining, and they're only going to be doing 5 measures, and they pretty much overlap with these NQF measures, collecting just these few variables and getting these very limited outcomes.
Hi, this is Sue Barnes with Kaiser Permanente and APIC. I just want to register a concern regarding adding a measure that is slightly different than another measure. So where we have NISQIP and facilities participating in NISQIP and a measure suggested following those guidelines, not that your approach is not reasonable, it's just I would raise a concern regarding harmonization of measures and surveillance burden, and although this might be presented as an option, it could be viewed as an addition. And there could also be resulting a significant amount of confusion when they're considering NISQIP light versus NISQIP, and then the whole issue of the existing method of reporting infection data for the perioperative or post-surgical arena is rate versus SIR. And so we're looking at complexity, adding complexity there. But this would add even another level, it seems, of complexity and potential confusion. So I just offer that concern.
So I didn't quite catch that last part of it. How did SIR get involved in here? Because we're talking about a rate here, either NISQIP light or NISQIP, it's going to be a rate.
Right, but NISQIP isn't a typical infection rate by discrete procedure.
So your question is harmonization with the NHSN.
Well, and harmonization of what I'm understanding, and maybe I'm understanding incorrectly, but what's being currently discussed is not a NISQIP measure, but NISQIP light or a slight variation on NISQIP, right?
Well, I thought, and maybe I'm not the expert on this, but I assumed that if somebody was participating in the regular full NISQIP,
you dropped out. But if they're participating in full NISQIP, they can do all these measures with the same data set.
Data set, and it's done in exactly the same way, Mark, or is there slight differences?
You broke off. I didn't hear the beginning of your question. I'm not hearing anything.
I think the question was whether there are slight differences.
Well the differences between the standard ACF NISQIP will choose from approximately 47 variables into a stepwise regression. This is just on the group of 3 variables, but the 3 are included in the 47. So if a hospital is participating under standard ACS NISQIP, they will be doing they'll get, you know, 47 different outcomes using 46 variables if they're in this small version, which is different than NISQIP Lite, which is another definition. If they're just in this program where they do these four or five different measures, they're only collecting a total of about eight variables for in Florida for their five measures. Five outcomes.
I guess that my question is, and I'm not sure I understand exactly what it takes to report this information if you're not a NISQIP site. Sounds like it's no problem if you're a NISQIP site, but if you're not, how burdensome is it given the other kinds of things that you have to collect to support HAI?
Well, yeah, they estimate that it's like, what is it, 0.3 or 0.4 FTEs. I'm not sure how – that hasn't been field tested. You know, I don't know what estimate, I guess.
But, well, that's their estimate. Usually for standard NISQIP, one FTE can collect data on about 1,600 cases per year, and if you look at this situation where you're collecting a data burden that's it's probably one tenth the size, you know, so you know, 300 to 500 to 600 is not unreasonable.
But, I mean, I think what NQF has said is we got to think about the science of it. And, I mean, I agree with Sue's concerns, and, you know, about confusion and harmonization with other measures. But I think for the, you know, I think our job is the TAP is the science. Is mainly the science, you know, as well as, you know, some comments about usability and feasibility. Is that not true?
That's accurate.
So,
one thing I would say to that, that is that there isn't any data here. And when you get to the feasibility, I guess, this is something new. It hasn't been tested. We don't know what the burden is going to be on a hospital to do this, in my mind. It would be, you know, if there's data out there, I'd like to see it, but I don't think there is.
Yeah, and then thinking about the science, I mean, I guess now I'm thinking it through, so this is me thinking a bit. But the validity is okay because although it was just a modeling exercise, it was done exercises, you know, the prior data has been valid, right?
Correct.
Okay, so that's all right.
And, you know, the C statistic is exactly the same in these two areas, so I guess you could use that as an argument.
Yeah. With
it. We talked about the feasibility. There's, you know, you need an EMR to do this.
And not all medical centers are participating. This is not a mandatory, it's not mandated in a number of states, although I understand that legislation, both state-based and federal, is moving towards NISQIP model for reporting. Currently, that's not the case, so this would involve additional surveillance burden.
Okay.
Any more comments on that measure? are we all set with that measure? Or do we have any more concerns? Any wrap up of the strengths and weaknesses? Or hearing none, I think we'll move at this point to a period of public comment. Operator, do we have anybody on the line who would like to offer a public comment?
Thank you. If you're currently online and you would like to make a comment at this time, please press star 1 on your touchtone telephone and we can open your lines individually. Once again, that's star 1 if you have a question or comment at this time. And we'll pause for just a moment to give everyone a chance to signal. And once again, if we have anyone on public that would like to make a statement or has a question at this time, please press star 1 on your touchtone telephone. And it appears we have no one in the queue at this time.
Okay, thanks. In that case, we will go ahead and take up the UTI measure again from the American College of Surgeons. And, Mark, I hope you're still with us.
I am.
Okay, great. Carolyn, Scott, I believe we had you as the discussion leader on this one. Do you want to give us a quick rundown of the your thoughts on this measure, any strengths, weaknesses you identified? You still on the line, Carolyn? She may have dropped off. Dr. Campbell, would you mind taking us through this measure? Or Pat Stone, I think we had assigned you this measure as well. Pat, are you there?
Well, I can go through it. I think Peter, the NISQIP measures UTI at 30 days. It doesn't have to be catheter related. It's just if you got a UTI or not within 30 days. And I think the as I look through this measure, I think the idea was similar to the previous measure. Can we make it easier for hospitals to participate in this, get some idea of their risk-adjusted data, and participate nationally
We lost Dr. Campbell there. Are you on speakerphone, Dr. Campbell?
Yeah, maybe I'll
go back to regular phone.
Okay. Yeah.
Using the same methodology, we go to about 15% of the hospitals are identified as high outliers, and this is thought to be a powerful method. Nobody likes to think of themselves as not being performing very well, so that motivates people to improve. They say the endorsed measure calculates the numerators, the number of indwelling catheter-associated UTIs. I didn't think it was catheter. Oh, I'm confused about that. Oh, no, I'm sorry. That's the previous NQF endorsement was the indwelling catheter-associated UTI in ICUs, and this one is different. This is just the numerators, the UTIs within 30 days, as I mentioned, after the operative procedure. Doesn't have anything to do with whether you had a catheter or not. And the denominator is any patient undergoing a procedure that is in the ACS NSQIP, which we're going to get some kind of summary of what those are. But I think it's mostly general vascular cases. So you'll get a risk-adjusted UTI based on this, and then hopefully that will be a motivator for quality improvement. So we can go through the, Mark, I don't know if you want to comment on that. If you don't, just chip in when you want to. But what about the importance to measure and report? Have we got consensus that UTIs are important?
I'm not sure if this is the place to raise the issue, but this is Sue Barnes again, and I just wanted to voice a concern that this would address the risk in one part of the patient population only.
Uh-huh. What do you mean?
Well, so it's just for post-op patients, right?
Yeah.
Not for the general continuum across the continuum of care. It is only for patients. So it also would not, so therefore it wouldn't be consistent with other measures that where UTI is already collected.
Yeah, well, that's, you're right. You're talking just about surgical things.
Right.
Yep. Yeah, so that's a harmonization thing, I guess. It's not really, it's not going to be able to harmonize somebody who hasn't had an operation. So.
And I think Sue was the only one to not vote that as completely meeting the importance criteria, so that I think you've addressed those concerns.
Okay.
I might have put it in the wrong place, so maybe it's not importance to measure, but possibly in one of the other categories.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, I think you have a point there. Okay, how about measure specifications in this scientific acceptability part? They have the definitions that are pretty well established in NSQIP, at least, for what a UTI actually is.
So, and again, I'm not sure if this is the right place to raise the issue, but I think that when you're, this might pose some confusion since UTIs that are measured elsewhere in the community of infection prevention are catheter associated.
Yep.
So non-catheter associated versus not catheter, you know, it just might create some confusion.
Yeah, point well taken.
The 30-day follow-up, is that consistent? How does that get done?
Yeah, actually, it is pretty good. The 30-day follow-up rate has been about 97%. So it's done by hook or by crook, either through the electronic medical record or by a postcard or by a phone call from the nurse. That's why it's, you know, it's this balance between getting really, really good data, but when you do that, it's expensive. You have to have a full-time FTE who does nothing but that. And so that's where the data comes from.
So I'm confused a little bit on this definition. You know, there's some criterion for the numerator, which is, you know, some clinical fever, urgency, frequency, urine culture, physician diagnosis, physician institutes appropriate antimicrobial therapy. So all these data points for the numerator, then I read about your reliability and validity testing, and it's only been done through modeling. Have these data points, you know, what sort of reliability and validity testing has been happened with those numerators since this, I guess, is a new measure for Ms. Quip, no?
No, UTI is not a new measure. One way I could answer that is that they do test some inter-rater reliability on a regular basis. So the people from outside a given institution come in and go through 80 or 100 cases to match up what they think about these various, complications or data points and the resident data collector. So that, if you don't have an inter-rater reliability score that's X, I think it's 85% concordance, then the data is not included in the total NISQIP database. So there's that. But if you're asking, does that really mean that that's a urinary tract infection in terms of these clinical things? I assume that they got this from CDC like we usually do.
So I think the CDC has changed its definition, but you know, so those things, you know, those are the sort of things that would be the definitions. But so there is an inter-rater reliability.
Oh yeah, and an audit. One of the strengths of the NSQIP is that it's not only the inter-rater reliability, but it is audited data. And most of the other QI registries don't have that auditing function. So if the audit doesn't show concordance, then that data is thrown out also. It isn't included in the database. So, those are pluses, but it makes it expensive and hard to, and people are working on that, you know, trying to make it less expensive.
So
then tell me, and I'm sorry, maybe I should have known this, but as you're busy, we're busy, we had to read all of these measures in a week. So this is not a new measure for Ms. Quip.
I believe, and I wasn't assigned to this one, so I believe that we've always measured UTIs in the past. NISQIP has always measured UTIs, but I believe that they were trying to make this an UTI light, if I recall.
It's not a new measure. Before it was modeled using the full set of predictors. Here it's just modeling using I think there's five predictors in this model.
Right.
The same as last one is that this is not as many predictors.
Right, but isn't the idea of what this to try to get, this is NISQIP light, I guess, you know, for hospitals that don't participate in the formal NISQIP program, they could join in using this.
Well, NISQIP Lite is actually a new version of NISQIP. This is very, very light.
Yeah, well, okay, that's what I mean.
Right.
I'm being facetious about that. But this is a way for hospitals who don't have the resources for full NISQIP or whatever NISQIP Lite is to participate in this process.
Okay, because it only uses five variables.
Right. Yep.
All right. Okay. Now I understand the differences.
And so is the definition an NHSN definition of infection?
Hello? I wish I had somebody there to tell me where that came from, but I don't.
I think it comes from an original definition of, this is what I think, is original definition of NHSN, but I think NHSN has moved away from that, some of those definitions in the more recent.
That's my understanding as well, which would raise a concern about confusion and different definitions.
Right. Yeah. Well, how can we resolve that? We could ask them what the source of their definition is.
For the numerator, yeah.
And we will, as staff, we'll contact ACS and ask for a clarification of that.
Okay. Okay. And so the denominator statement, they have any, again, this thing, any of the listed CPT surgical procedures except certain CPTs involving the urinary tract, and there's 8 or 10 of them listed here. So that, you know, I guess if you had a prostatectomy and something, that wouldn't be, I don't know what those codes are, but there's 8 or 10 CPTs that are excluded from this. And that, you know, that's, again, that's going to be a harmonization issue with some other metric, I'm sure, because this is what the college decided to exclude. Okay, and again, trauma is excluded under some circumstances. Patient who's admitted for transplant is excluded. And again, the brain death category is excluded. Okay. Again, the modeling seems quite extensive to me. Any other comments about that? The reliability testing is here.
And, no, it seems good.
Okay. Okay. Let's see. I'm just going to stop anybody from piping in anytime you want to. I'm just looking through the identification of meaningful differences in performance here. This is the statistical part of it. That seems to be fairly solid, I think. Again, they bring up this UHC paper where NISQIP was much more sensitive than the UHC data was. You know, and the implication is that that's sort of the gold standard for this, at least in the surgical area. And again, they say that measure specifications are not harmonized with the, I skipped over to 3 already, to the reliability part. the measure specimens, are they harmonized? If not, why? And if the previous measure was, I read this before, where we're just looking at catheter-associated UTIs in an ICU, and that's not what this measure looks at.
That's the NHSN measure. Maybe
yeah.
Not.
Is it the previous one that's endorsed by
ICU and the catheter-associated UTIs.
Okay. So that's, again, that's going to be for the steering committee, I suppose, to determine whether it's additional value to add another UTI metric that's specific for postoperative patients. And hopefully that won't be too confusing to folks. And then the feasibility issue, again, we get back down to this, how many, they, using a conservative estimate, 0.125 to 0.333 of an FTE will be needed to collect the data for the measure. But my experience with that is it's really hard to estimate that until you actually test it. But there's no data about that.
Yeah.
Okay, so any more feasibility concerns about this?
Not from me.
Okay, so we're hearing that it's, we're hearing that this, the data collection and the modeling and analysis is fairly solid. There's questions about how this fits into the bigger scheme of things. Whether it's something that a hospital can actually do, whether it should be harmonized in some way with other metrics. Okay, are we losing our audience here?
I think we're losing steam.
We're losing steam? Okay. Anybody else have any other comments about 007? James Bond, 007, James Bond metric. No, okay, well,
does
I think...
sound like it. Are we all wrapped up with that one?
I think we're wrapped up with that one.
All right. Well, then I'll ask the operator to see if there's any public comment again.
And once again, just as a reminder, if you have a comment or question at this time, please press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone. Again, that's star 1 for questions or comments at this time. And we'll pause for just a moment to give everyone a chance to signal. And once again, that's star 1 if you have a question or a comment at this time. And it appears we have no one in the queue at this time.
Okay, great. In that case, thanks everybody for your participation. I'll just run through some next steps here. We will be summarizing the results of this call, and we'll be distributing those to the TAP. And again, we'll be following up with the measure developers to clarify some questions. If you have any, as the TAP members have anything, again, you want to remind us of, something particular you want clarified, please email us and let us know about that. We've taken notes as well, and we'll be making some requests of the measure developers. Once we circulate that to the committee, or to the TAP rather, we'll be, again, giving you another survey tool for you to do your final evaluations of the measures. After that, we will forward on the results of those evaluations to the steering committee. Dr. Campbell will be participating in the steering committee, so he will be there to represent the TAP's deliberations to the steering committee. If you have any questions, again, feel free to contact us and let us know if you have any questions or concerns.
Andrew, I just have a quick process question.
Sure.
When do you think we'll be doing this voting?
I would say within the next 10 days or so.
Well, I very well likely will. I'm going to be on vacation starting next week for 2 weeks, so I don't know my internet access.
Right. All right, we'll try to get it to you before then.
And Peter, just about the steering committee participation, I'm happy to participate up to and including, but not including that one. I think the date that you picked was end of October, was it not? October 28th or something?
Oh, for this, it's actually, we'll be doing this in late August, likely less.
Yeah, okay, I'm fine with that. Yeah, good. I just, I had a conflict on that last October 28th thing.
Good. All right, okay. On that note, thanks everybody again for participating. Thanks for taking the time to get on this call and sticking through it with us. And we will be in contact again with you shortly.
Okay, thank you everybody.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation.